Blog Talk Radio.
Return of the Mac. It's one of my favorite treadmill songs. It's what I use if I'm running on the treadmill. I can just go forever. It's kind of that upbeat, and if you get into the right rhythm, you can just run forever. It is a wonderful day out here in Southern California. Actually, we started having summer about a week ago. It got into the 80s. I mean, it was literally hot, where you could open your front door and it was literally cooler outside because your house was baking all day. Today it's overcast. It's overcast and it's high 60s. You know, nothing to complain about. You know, we're not in the 30s or 20s like back east, but actually just a pleasant day. What we could use, and I think it's actually what we're going to get tomorrow, is some rain. That's what Southern California needs, is rain, rain, rain. So I think that's going to happen tomorrow. On the show today, we're going to get into the Supreme Court. There's more going on with Justice Antonin Scalia's untimely death over the weekend. The little bit of scandal going on about it. You know, did he die of natural causes or what goes on? And there's a weird kind of way that they handle deaths in Texas, I guess because the state is so big. You can't have what is considered in most other states called the coroner. They literally can do the coronation. They can do their job over the phone. It's like a verbal thing. If I guess the sheriff is on one end, the coroner can literally sign off on the. It's really kind of weird. But I guess there's just so Texas is so big, wide open spaces, and he was found with a pillow. I don't know if he was slumped over. Obviously, we're not going to get a picture because who wants to see that? But he was when they went into the room of Judge Scalia's or Justice Scalia's, he was asleep, obviously, or he had been asleep that night. At some point in the evening, he passed away. But the pillow was between the headboard and his head. So, and, you know, the whole allegation was, did someone put a pillow over his face to suffocate him? It's gotten into a whole lot of things. And the family did not want an autopsy. The speculation, and there's been a little bit more than speculation, is he did have some health issues. So, you know, people are going to take it. There's this gentleman that's on the radio. People, you may have heard his name before. His name is Alex Jones. All he does is tell you that the Martians are getting ready to come, or that whenever anyone dies, there's a conspiracy involved. And so this one with the justice is just rife for conspiracy theories. So he's kind of run away with that. But at any rate, the whole thing with now the president, President Obama, gets a chance to nominate a new justice within an hour of the passing of Justice Scalia on Saturday. Republicans came out and said, we will not even consider adding a justice on. This president will not get a chance to add another justice because right now there's normally 9 justices. Right now it's 4 and 4, and it's basically 4 conservative, 4 liberal, for lack of a better term, or 4 nominated by Republican presidents, 4 nominated by Democratic presidents. So this next justice that gets nominated will be the tipping point. So Republicans pretty much closed the door very quickly on Saturday afternoon, and it's literally now they have to walk it back. Sometimes the Republican Party, the politicians in Washington, D.C., they try to act tough, so therefore they come out early and say, we're not going to do this, or we're not going to do that, or the president won't get this, the president doesn't get that. If they play poker, they'd be the type that would tell you their hand as soon as they see it. Keep quiet. Even if you wanted to do what you wanted to do on Saturday, just keep quiet. First of all, would it be nice to maybe give some respects to the family? That would help a little. You know, be nice to the family. And then say, you know, the president, this is the concept. And again, Republicans who are so interested in talking about the Constitution and following the Constitution. Well, in the Constitution, Article 2, Section 2, it says the president shall nominate, ... And then the senators get to advise and consent. But to come out right at the beginning, within an hour, and say, no, we're not going to even entertain a nomination, it's not going to happen. Already, it's what now, 4 days later? They've already backed up off of that. Now, the chairman of the committee, the judicial committee that interviews, for lack of a better word, the nominating justice, he's already said, and this is Senator Grassley from Iowa, he's already now saying, well, we may have some interviews with her. We may talk to them. Yeah. He's still got a year left in his term. It was really a silly spectacle that the Republicans put on, and now they have to back up, which now will make the people who are supporting them in the country angry, because at first you said you weren't going to do anything, which a lot of people were happy about. I don't think majority of the country, but a lot of people were like, yeah, don't give President Obama anything. Stop it. Don't even consider it. Wait till after election. And now they're backing up, and now those people are mad at him. And that is primarily why you get a Donald Trump leading in the Republican field right now. So speaking of him, right now the next primary is this Saturday. It's in South Carolina. It's only the Republican Party. The Democrats are having their primary in South Carolina a week from Saturday. I think this Saturday the Democrats are having a caucus in Nevada. So the primary this weekend, Trump is pulling away. He's pulling away in South Carolina. This man can do no wrong. He can say or do anything. And I'm going to get into some of the things he's been saying that have really opened up a split in the Republican Party, made some people angry. Some people agree with him. These are things that would have been said by Democrats, and the Democrat would have been yelled down by Republicans. But now Trump has no resistance. Everyone is Teflon. They used to call President Reagan the Teflon president. Trump is the Teflon candidate. Jeb Bush, this was thought to be his big state, that he could finally get something done in South Carolina. He had his brother, President Bush 43, in on Monday to speak for him at a campaign rally in South Carolina. And, you know, you really haven't seen much of the former president. In fact, I'm hearing just before I came on today, within the last half hour, there's been criticism by a former state Republican chair, Dawson, Caitlin Dawson, I believe his name is, Dawson. And he's really upset with the president that he hasn't been around. You haven't seen him for the last 7-8 years. He left office in 2009, January 2009, and you really haven't seen him. All you've seen is his paintings. He's been painting. But he's really kind of kept a low profile. He's being criticized by some people in South Carolina because he has not been around. He's just kind of been hidden, and they're saying, you know, we don't like the guy, but Bill Clinton is out there stumping for candidates the last 3 or 4 years. You saw him at the Democratic National Convention in 2012. He helped President Obama. He's out there. He's visible. We don't like him, but at least he's working for him. We can't get the same from President Bush. Ouch. My goodness. So nasty to the Bush family. So President Bush won the South Carolina primary in 2000 against John McCain. Nasty primary. Some dirty tricks going on in that one. And it was thought that Jeb Bush would be able to pull it off this time, and with his brother coming in, the former president, that he would be able to pull this one out. It doesn't look like it. It really doesn't look like it. And this may be the last primary for Jeb Bush. If he does as poor as people are thinking he's going to do, which is single digits, right now Trump has about 35, 36, 37%. Then you have Marco Rubio, Ted Cruz, John Kasich is somewhere there in the mix. I think actually probably a little bit below Ted Cruz. And then Jeb Bush is in fifth behind them. He's 8 or 9% right now. In some polls, I've even seen as low as 4%. If he doesn't get out of this, if he's under 10%, I don't see how he goes forward. If he's under 5%, that is just embarrassing. It's really, after you had your brother, the former president, come in the week of the primary, and he's literally no help. Because right now, Donald Trump is the man. And part of the thing that has given him even more oxygen right before President Bush came in to South Carolina was the debates last Saturday when Donald Trump was talking about the former president. It was his fault 9/11 happened. He pointed the finger at Bush. Now, this is something that only Democrats are supposed to do. Not supposed to hear that from Republicans, so-called Republicans. A lot of Republicans think Donald Trump is just an in-disguise Democrat who's buddy-buddy with the Clintons, and eventually he will show his true colors. Has he been buddy-buddy with the Clintons? Absolutely. I don't know if – I think he would try to win if he gets the nomination. But getting back to this whole thing, this was a huge issue last weekend that Donald Trump would get up there and say 9/11 was George Bush's fault. It happened on his watch, because the normal statements have always been George Bush, President Bush, kept us safe after 9/11. He kept us safe. Well, Donald Trump has come out with the thing that I kind of always thought when I used to hear that back in the 2000s. He ain't kept us safe, but what about 9/11? But, you know, you didn't really hear that much in public because people were trying to rally around the flag and trying to support the country after the huge terror attack that 9/11 was. Now, if it had been President Obama in office during 9/11 or President Al Gore, which almost did happen, other than those Florida Chads, if President Gore would have said, I've kept you safe since 9/11, can you hear what the Republicans would have said in response? They would have had him out of there in no time. No time. He'd have been gone. But somehow, that was the line that George Bush used, President Bush. And I hope you kind of noticed, whenever I try to talk about former presidents, I really do try to say as much as I can, president, former president. I don't like to say Reagan, Johnson, Obama. I try to use their formal title and try to be somewhat respectful to the office, even if I wasn't a fan of the particular president, former President Nixon. And then Donald Trump was talking about weapons of mass destruction, and there were none. What was this big lie about weapons of mass destruction? Whoa. I mean, he went for it. And everyone is now thinking, oh, Donald Trump has said all these horrible things. He's made fun of disabled people. He attacked Megyn Kelly of Fox News. He attacked John McCain about his war record and not really being a hero because he was a prisoner of war. Nothing has seemed to hurt him. Now, finally, criticizing former President Bush about 9/11 and lying about weapons of mass destruction, will this finally be it? No. He's even stronger this past week, and he may win this primary running away. If he gets to 40%, it will be so impressive, and he may have this nomination sewn up after the so-called SEC primaries, when most of the states, there are about 10 or 12 primaries going on at one time, March 1st. A lot of them are in the South, so they're calling the SEC primaries. He's going to have this sewn up by the end of March. Donald Trump, the Republican candidate for President of the United States. Put that in your pipe and smoke it. It is a crazy world. Who would have thought that 1 year ago, right? Marco Rubio is got the endorsement from the governor of the state, Nikki Haley. The fight will be for second place between Rubio, Cruz, and Kasich, who is going to come in number two. And what this, if there's going to be any challenge to Donald Trump, this field has got to get winnowed out. You got to start getting some people out of here, because Donald Trump right now, the challenge is, can Donald Trump get towards 50% of the Republican vote? Because right now he's been in the mid-30s, high 30s, up to 38, 39. Can he get over 40 into 45%? And the only way we're going to find out is if the rest of these, whoever is going to end up out of Rubio Bush, looks like it's going to be Rubio, and you're going to have Cruz, and then if Kasich doesn't do well, then he's going to be out. And then you're going to have basically a three-person race of Trump, Rubio, and Senator Ted Cruz. Now you got three people in the race. Now who's going to get the majority? No more 5, 6, 7, 12 people, Christie and Carly Fiorina and Huckabee. Everyone's gone. Now it's down to three people. Now can someone break through the mold and get past Donald Trump when it's down to three people as opposed to when it was 8, 9, 10, 15? Ben Carson, you know, I forgot he's still in the race, but you know, he's almost invisible. He's so quiet. So we will find out what happens this weekend. But right now it's just looking like it's going to be a real big Trump win. On the Democratic side, at least as it goes in South Carolina, Hillary Clinton still has a big lead. She's gotten a lot of support from the African-American community. The inroads that Bernie Sanders is trying to make in that community, they've taken hold a little, especially with younger African-Americans and just younger people in general, but not enough to, at this point, defeat the Clintons, or to defeat Hillary Clinton. Might as well say the Clintons, because it's Bill and Hillary in this one. Definitely, they're definitely running as a team. Bernie Sanders did a great job in New Hampshire. He practically tied in Iowa, the caucuses. And he is getting huge, and there's huge crowds all over the country. His challenge has been, can he get beyond, as a senator from the state of Vermont with his 95% white, can he start to diversify his voters, his electorate? Because if he's not able to diversify in South Carolina and Nevada and then going into states like Florida, Ohio, Michigan, Illinois, Missouri, Arkansas, if he's not able to diversify, and then obviously late June out here in California, will he be able to hang on? I believe Senator Sanders is still going to, he's going to be able to get some votes. What I have seen so far with him, though, is he's going to have a problem with the African-American vote. And I'm looking into why he is getting, obviously, he's just been able to pull in great crowds. You know, Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders are the two stars of this whole political year so far, since last summer, with the crowds they're getting in, with the enthusiasm they're engendering, with the things they're talking about. You know, Trump has a very straightforward, clean message. We're going to build a wall. We're going to beat ISIS. We're going to stop these trade deals. They don't know how to do deals. I know how to do deals. We're going to make better deals. And Bernie Sanders with the system is rigged. Wall Street is a fraud. We're going to tear down the banks. We're going to give the power back to the people. Now, with Bernie Sanders, a lot of, I'm saying with the millennials, these the younger, the new voters, these voters that are basically between 18 and 30. So when you look back, these are voters that would have been 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years old during the Clinton years, the first term of Bill Clinton. And, you know, some of them would have been about that same age during impeachment. So they would, you know, for 18-year-old, who's just a first-time voter this year, 18, 19-year-old, they may have been born in 1997, 1998. They would have no recollection of the whole impeachment issue. Or what happened, obviously, they would not even have been born in the first term, 1992 to 1995, 1996, because a lot of the discussion has been about what the Clintons did wrong those years when they signed, President Clinton signed a crime bill in 1994, and he revamped the welfare system in 96. This was prior to the election. This prior to running against Bob Dole in 96. They redid welfare. And he's been heavily criticized for both bills, and by extension, his wife, who's obviously the one running for president, has been criticized because she endorsed the crime bill and the welfare bill. What I would like to try to help millennials explain, because the criticism is strictly for Hillary, strictly for President Clinton. You made the a prison industrial complex. It was just people going to jail, people going to jail, people getting in jail for drugs for no reason. Welfare, people were demonized for being on welfare. I want to kind of help see if I can help millennials with this, because I don't know if you absolutely are getting this right. First of all, let's be clear about something. In this country, United States, in the 1980s, 1990s, there was a crime problem. You think we have a crime problem now? Crime has been steadily going down since the 1990s through the 2000s. Crime has dropped over the last 20 years. In the 1980s, 1990s, with the drug epidemic, crack cocaine, the whole deal in the cities, especially the inner cities. Now we know heroin and all the opioids are all over the outer burbs, exurbs, out far out. A lot of younger white people, middle-aged white people are getting into the heroin, and it's causing some huge problems. But in the 1980s and 1990s, there was a crime problem. Yes, there were some bad police issues, to be sure, but there was real crime and real criminals. Somebody needed to go to jail. They were not all innocents. That's what you need to know. Now, go ahead and still complain that the Clintons did this horrible crime bill and they sent too many people to jail. Well, yes, President Clinton signed that bill. Hillary Clinton endorsed that bill. Let's not forget about a Senator Joe Biden, now vice president, and also a representative in the 1990s from Vermont by the name of Bernie Sanders. He voted for the crime bill. But here are the names that you also need to remember. And this is very important in terms of how the crime bill got formed. I'm going to list some names for you. You may not have heard them before. Henry Hyde, Illinois. Bob Walker, Pennsylvania. Bob Barr, Georgia. John Micah, Florida. Newt Gingrich, Georgia, became Speaker of the House. Dick Armey, Texas, Majority Leader. Tom DeLay, the Hammer, was his nickname, also from Texas, the Whip. He was the guy that made sure they had enough votes to pass whatever they wanted or whatever they wanted. He was the Hammer. Tough guy. John Kasich, who's running for president this year. He was in Congress in the 1990s. Joe Scarborough, a guy that's on cable news now from Florida. He was in Congress. And please, let's not forget, I'll just name two senators. Senator Jesse Helms, Senator Strom Thurmond. Please go look them up. Every name that I just mentioned were Republicans. And at the time that the crime bill was passed, both houses were majority Democrat. And that's how the crime bill was passed, by Democrats. Because if the Republicans would have had their way with that crime bill, you think that the crime bill that got passed was bad. And there had to be some bill passed. There was not going to be no bill passed. This was in, before the midterm elections in 1994, spring of 1994. Some bill had to be passed, or otherwise Democrats were going to be hurt. Bill Clinton, office 2 years. He came into office in 1993 with the old don't ask, don't tell, and gays in the military. That got him started off on the bad foot. Tried to get health care passed. They tried. That went down in flames. So in 1994, they had to get the crime bill passed. There was no, well, we won't do it. We'll put it off till next year. It would, no. And if the Democrats weren't going to pass it, what the Republicans wanted was 10 times worse. Newt Gingrich, Jesse Helms from North Carolina, Strom Thurmond. So these were the people who, if they would have had a chance to write their version of the bill in the 1990s, you would have really had something to complain about. So please, millennials who are for Bernie Sanders because you don't trust Hillary Clinton. And if you don't, if it's not that, then you'll have something else that you don't like about it. But this one needs to come off the books. You know, complain about the emails, complain about her effectiveness as a Secretary of State. But this whole idea about the crime bill in 1994 and then the welfare bill right before the reelection in 1996, they redid the bill. It was worse than the one that they wanted president. And now remember, in 1996, the House is now Newt Gingrich. It went from Democrat to Republican in the midterm 1994. So that crime bill in the spring of 94, that was all Democrats were able to vote that bill in. By 1996, it's now Speaker of the House Newt Gingrich. Republicans have the House. Democrats have the Senate. And they had to come up with something. And the first bill, Bill Clinton did not sign. He said, no, take this back. I can't do it. They redid it and changed a few things on it. And then he signed it. He had to sign it again. If you wanted Newt Gingrich to write the bill, it would have been even worse. So I think that this issue eventually, and I hope Secretary Clinton can explain herself better, because it's an issue that needs to come off the discussion. There are other things that we can discuss about her and challenge her on that makes sense. This one does not make sense. It just does not. So hopefully that will move on. like I said, Hillary Clinton has a big lead in South Carolina. In the Nevada caucus, it's close. It's literally heads up. It's going to be a coin flip. I think what's going to happen with the Democrats is, and this you wouldn't have even bet this 1 year ago. 1 year ago, people would have said, well, Hillary Clinton's going to have a pretty easy time. Yeah, the senator from Vermont may run against her, but no competition. And then with the there's 17 people in the GOP, that thing's going to go forever. We don't know when they're going to figure out. They may have to go to the convention in August and still not know who the person who's going to be nominated. Well, how things have changed. Because now it looks like Donald Trump is going to take care of this thing before the end of March, within 30 days. And Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders on the Democratic side are going to be fighting till May or June. Seriously. Bernie Sanders is going to have enough delegates to keep this thing interesting. His challenge is, and I think what's going to be a huge fight in the Democratic, and this is getting a little inside baseball, this whole thing with superdelegates. The Democrats have made this rule, and it's not in the Republicans. I don't think they have it, but the Democrats do have it. They've had it for over 50, back in the 1950s it started. And essentially what it is each state gets so many delegates that are, for lack of a better term, well-known people, governors, senators, congresspeople, maybe state in the state legislature, maybe certain mayors of certain cities. They're called superdelegates. And they get to decide who they want to be for, irregardless of how their state votes. So let's say a state votes for Bernie Sanders 60-40, and it's a big state. He wins the state delegates, and they are proportional. Most Democratic states are proportional. So if Bernie Sanders were to win a state 60-40, he'd get 60% of the delegates. And let's say the delegates are 100. Let's make it simple. So he would get 60 delegates. Hillary Clinton would get 40. Ah, contraire. But out of those 100 delegates, there are also some superdelegates. And let's say there's 20 of them. Certain senators, certain legislature people, congressmen, just well-known name people. So out of that 20, you pull those out of the 80. Now Sanders gets something like 50 of the delegates, maybe 53, 54 out of those 80. And Hillary gets 35, 34, but she gets those 20. Let's say those 20 superdelegates are like, they've always been. They can pick and choose whoever they want to be with. They can change any day of the week. Tuesday, they can be for Hillary. Wednesday, they can be for Bernie. Thursday, they can go back to being for Hillary. They are floating. But let's say Bernie wins 53, Hillary wins 37, but then she gets the 20 superdelegates. All of a sudden, she gets 57. Or excuse me, 80, 53, Bernie, 27, Hillary. Then Hillary gets to 20, so she ends up with 47, and Bernie has 53, but he won 60 to 40%. So Bernie Sanders people, I think once they get down to the convention in August, and if this type of thing happens, if Bernie overall, once all the primaries are done, ends up, let's say he's down, let's say Hillary wins 54% of all the primary votes. Bernie wins about 45, 46%. But Hillary ends up having delegates that almost come out to about 60%. It's just because of the superdelegates. And there's going to just be a huge, as Bernie Sanders would say, huge issue with that. But we'll see how that goes. It's going to happen. This is a story that just came out today, and this is an unbelievable story. And it's about Apple. People that have iPhones, or even if you have a Google phone, listen up, because this is going to be huge. Apple opposes an order to unlock the San Bernardino killer's phone. So we know about the massacre in San Bernardino last November, a few weeks after that horrible massacre in Paris with the terrorist ISIS. And then it happened here in California, which is about an hour east of Los Angeles, San Bernardino. And one of the killers, who ended up obviously dying that day, had a phone, iPhone. And what the government is asking Apple to do is unlock this phone so we can find out whose numbers were on there, who did he text and talk to, did they, there are certain codes and certain things that they said so that they could transfer information, what apps did they use to transfer information to the terrorists overseas. The government wants to know this information, so much so that yesterday, actually it just happened today, Apple said that they would oppose and they would challenge a federal court order to help the FBI unlock an iPhone used by one of the attackers. The government wants Apple to bypass the security functions on this particular iPhone. It's the iPhone 5C, used by the killer whose name was Syed Farouk. The judge ordered Apple to build special software that would essentially act as a skeleton key, a master key, if you will, capable of unlocking the phone. So here's the issue, everyone. We all, let's say we have iPhones, and this software is also pertinent to Google phones. When you die, and if no one knows the safety code to get into your phone, that phone is locked forever. No one can get into it. Apple specifically has decided not to have a master key. That whenever someone says, listen, you know, my loved one died, we have the phone here and we wanted to get some information out of it. Can you unlock this key port? Apple would say, no, we don't have a master key. We don't do that. We have no master key. There's no way we can get into it. We don't have any system set up to do that. You're going to have to either try to figure it out, or what normally happens is people get the phone and they can have it redone, which would erase everything on the phone, but you start over, but you lose all that information on the phone. But in terms of having that phone and getting the information off that phone, unless you know the passwords the person had on that phone, you are SOL. So the government wants Apple to set up a password system, a security key, or a skeleton key, as they call it. Apple says, no, we're not doing that. We're not going to do that. So now there's going to be a showdown between Apple and the government, because the federal court just told them, you need to make a skeleton key. We need a key. Apple said, no, we're going to do it. Make us do it. Whoa. Now, here's the thing. I can sit here logically and tell you that a terrorist who may be passing along secrets to some ISIS member in Syria or Iraq, or to the government in Iran, God forbid, that I would want to know what he has on that phone, and we should be able to unlock that phone. That sounds good. But as with so many things legal, you can't just make one case and then not have it apply to everyone else. Because if we can do it with this person, then we can do it with other people. And if we can do it with other people, then maybe the Apple and Google will have that secret skeleton key. That will allow you to open it up whenever you sign a piece of paper and say, yes, we want this phone opened up so we can look inside and see what's in it. Apple doesn't want to do it, and the government is trying to make them do it. Where do you stand on this issue? Because I know where I stand on the issue in terms of this particular person, this terrorist who was killed. I want to know what's on that phone. And someday, what if someday there is literally a ticking time bomb and there is something on a particular phone that we need to know, and if we don't find out within the next 2 hours, you know, I'm not trying to scare anyone here, but I'm just saying, what if somebody had something on the phone that literally could cause a huge terrorist attack? And Apple and Google both say, no, we're not getting in the phone. We're not doing it. And the government says, no, you have to. It's going to happen. This is a huge issue. It's going to get itself worked out some way. The FBI has said that its experts have been unable to access data on Mr. Farouk's iPhone, and that only Apple could bypass its security features. FBI experts have said they risk losing the data permanently after 10 failed attempts to enter the password because of this phone's security features. And we're all familiar with that. You try to put in your security code, you know, every once in a while I'll miss one, I'll miss it twice, I may miss it three times. If you miss the 10 times trying to put in your password, the phone crashes and you lose all your data. So the FBI, in this case, with this terrorist phone, has been able to try to enter the passwords, and I'm sure they have algorithms where they could try to figure out passwords. Because they have possession of the phone. The FBI has the phone, but they just haven't tried. And I'm sure they are just trying. You know, we see it on TV. Now, see, when we know what happens at the end of the show and everything gets fixed, you know, you see these people plug in a phone into a computer and you see all the numbers flash and flash and flash, and then they start, one number pops up, two, three, four numbers, and oh, that's the password. It's done. Well, just think about this. The FBI is doing this every day and can't figure out the password. That is amazing. So the Justice Department and secured a search warrant for the phone owned by Mr. Farouk's former employer. So it was a company phone that he had. And the county, the San Bernardino County Department of Public Health, which owned the phone that they let the employee use, the terrorists, they consented to the search. This is a fascinating story. I think it has a long way to go, and we're probably going to find out something about it in the next few days, and stay tuned. Someone, we were talking the other day, I was talking with some people, and I'm gonna bring up Ronda Rousey in a few minutes, but I want to talk about this whole thing with the greatest generation. I'm sure you've heard the phrase before, greatest generation. Who's the greatest generation? Normally, what it pertains to is it pertains to the men and women who fought for our country during World War II. So, you know, between 1939, 1945, all the women who worked in the factories, what do they call it, Betsy the Riveter, all the men, obviously, who went to war. A lot who didn't come back. They were called our greatest generation. And I remember once in the 1990s, it was actually the 50th anniversary of D-Day, June 6th, 1944. So 1994, I was watching C-SPAN. They did a whole weekend on it, just a whole weekend on the 50th anniversary. And I just watched it, you know, I was watching it on Friday and, you know, go in and out of it on Saturday, Sunday, but I knew which all the programs that were coming on hour by hour for the whole weekend. And I remember just not seeing much about, you know, Tuskegee Airmen or, you know, any of the black soldiers who were in the war. And it started making me think then, this is back in the 90s, 1994, it's like, man, we don't think much about those men. But it also made me think about, why are we calling them the greatest generation? Now, think about this. We had our major news anchors on the ABC, CBS, NBC, we had Tom Brokaw write a book about World War II and the Greatest Generation. Peter Jennings, ABC, wrote a book in the 90s about the Greatest Generation. And Dan Rather. All three of them wrote books about World War II and the Greatest Generation. And I appreciate that. Listen, soldiers deserve our respect. I absolutely get that. My issue has always been, just my issue, is the Greatest Generation obviously practiced segregation over even overseas. As we were fighting the war to free the Europeans, they did not treat the African-American soldiers equally. And the story has always been told that they treated the African-American soldiers, their own Americans, worse than they treated the German and Italian prisoners of war. So that's one issue. And they were segregated. They couldn't fight with the white soldiers. They were weren't even allowed to go into war until at the end. Eisenhower had to use them at one point. He really almost didn't have anyone left, and he ended up using them. And they fought honorably and very well, as they should have. They wanted to fight for the country. But I think the thing that's always bothered me is then the war is over. So we free Europe. Free Japan with the help of two atomic bombs. And we come home, the war is over, and the African-American soldiers are then segregated and still not treated fairly, even after having fought for the country, by in part the same people that they fought with in the war. I've always thought that was one of the most cynical, mean things that could be done to our fellow citizens who were veterans. Came back from the war, weren't able to use the GI Bill the same as their white counterpart, certainly were not able to move into the suburbs like a lot of the veterans did after the war. They came home, married their girlfriends, their women, and went out and had families, started moving to the suburbs, that so-called white flight from the cities. Left the inner cities to the mostly African Americans. They weren't allowed to move much of anywhere else. Then those areas weren't taken care of because they were ignored. Meanwhile, the suburbs get built up. Cars are becoming more plentiful. Gasoline, more plentiful. Jobs, more plentiful. But only for certain people. And then we come into the 1950s. And obviously, the whole thing with Dr. King and Rosa Parks and segregation. And the people that were fighting against that, that was a lot of veterans from the war. And if they weren't actually veterans, they most certainly were in that same generation. They knew what was going on. You know, I've always found that to be just one of our most distasteful periods, and I have a hard time ever calling it the Greatest Generation. Listen, when you see some of the war movies and see what actually went on when they went on to the French coastline and how just the guns were blazing and you were almost on a suicide mission. I'm not denying anyone their service and their heroism, especially if you came back, because we know there are a lot of people didn't come back. But I just found it unreal that we would free Europeans but not treat our fellow Americans with the same respect. And it's something that has had to have been fought for. And obviously over the years, that's what the freedom was about in civil rights in 1965. But it's always been a little hesitation for me to talk about Greatest Generation, because I don't think the Greatest Generation acted as they should have. I think they came up short. That's my two cents on the Greatest Generation. I will always respect people who've given service, but I think the country, we did some things wrong after the war that could have been done better. From 1946 to 1965, to me, it's just a big question mark. Why? Why? Why do we have to do it this way after having already done it 200 years prior to, almost 200 years prior? Let's change subject. I'm going to talk about this MMA boxer, Ronda Rousey. Now, I don't know how many of you follow MMA. It is literally fist fighting. They wear little gloves that basically look like batting gloves that are padded. But they're really hitting each other, and they can kick. And it is very physical. It gets bloody. It has been a male-dominated sport. And for me, as someone who grew up with boxing and Muhammad Ali and Joe Frazier and heard about Rocky Marciano a little bit before my time, but you know, all the great boxers way back when, I've always been partial to boxing. Went and saw an MMA fight, which is a tournament, it's a series of fights, you know, not just one. You go through the weight classes, so you see about 8-9 fights all together. Saw one a few years ago, and I tell you, for the next 2 days, I had no voice. I was screamed out. You really kind of get into it there. But in general, I don't follow it. I'm more of a boxing fan. Well, boxing has really gone downhill. MMA has not taken it over, but it's there. So it's been more of a male-dominated sport. You don't see as many women in it. But this young lady by the name of Ronda Rousey has been the biggest thing in the last 2 years. She was unbeaten up through this past November, and she was unbeaten in a very popular style. She would get in there and very aggressive and just knock people out. She had this certain move that tied them up in knots, and they had to just concede. Otherwise, she was going to break their – it was an arm bar. It was a type of hold that she would have their arm. And if you didn't say, I'm done, stop, she could take your arm out of your socket, literally disconnect your arm from your shoulder. She was successful, unbeaten. Well known, and she doesn't help. It helped that she was photogenic, very attractive woman. Just started doing a lot of media. She became a very popular person in 2015. And then she came to last fall, last November. She came into the ring, hardly even shook her opponent's hand because her whole thing was this whole mental thing and showing people how tough she was, and she wasn't going to take anything from anybody, and she barely gave her opponent any respect before the fight. The opponent's name was Holly Holm, H-O-L-M. And as that fight began, Holly Holm commenced to whooping the holy crap out of Ronda Rousey for 2 rounds. By the second round, they had to stop it. She was a bloody mess. This was not a close fight at all. So the unbeaten fighter who was famous, you saw her picture everywhere, photogenic, attractive, doing movies, you know, all these covers of magazines, got beat to a bloody pulp. They said that she couldn't eat an apple for 3 to 4 weeks. She hid in her house because she was really beat up. She got beat up bad. She got kicked in the face, punched in the face, punched on the ground, continually pummeling her. This is about 6 or 7 minutes total of just domination by Holly Holm. And that was last November. Haven't seen much of her until late January. All of a sudden, the Sports Illustrated swimsuit issue is coming out. And you saw that she's now on the front cover. And she's done some TV shows this past week. And she spoke about the fact that she really was down after the fight in November. And she contemplated suicide. Now, some people have taken that revelation by Ronda to say, who are you talking about? I mean, you got it made. You made all this money. You were great. You're unbeaten. You lost one fight, and all of a sudden you're talking about suicide? Get out of here. You think you are. I'm going to might as well feel sorry for you. I think whether it's a cry for help or a cry for attention, if somebody mentions suicide, if they actually vocally mention it, as opposed to not saying anything, which too often happens, if somebody mentions it, I think that's a cry for help. Then you have to also remember, she lost her father through suicide. She was brought up for a good portion of her life by her stepfather. And I believe that's her Rousey name. I believe it's her stepfather's name, Rousey. But she lost her father at the age of 8 by suicide. So I have to take that. You have to take that seriously. You have to take that seriously. And it's too bad that people think it's just a plea for attention or you know, she's just trying to make people feel sorry for her. I don't care if she is making people feel sorry for her. For anyone to even say it, if you're asking for the attention, you don't know what people can do, because there's too many people who go along quietly and not say anything. And the next thing you know, it happened last week to a young man who killed himself on the steps of the Ohio state legislature. Advocate for against police brutality. It's a horrible thing. So on that down note, I'm going to end the show today. I'll be back on Friday at 12 noon. I'm going to do Free Flow Friday. Just come up with a few things that are going on. Talk more about Donald Trump. Donald Trump is having a town hall meeting tonight, and I hope that somebody asks him questions, not just only ask him questions, but then follow up. Because it's not the question, because then he gives you an answer, but it's not pertinent to what you just asked. Ask him the follow-up, because we need to see if he can actually start thinking some things through, because we haven't gotten to how this wall is going to get paid, literally how it's going to be paid, how are you going to do some of the things that you want to do. So he's going to be tonight, and then I think tomorrow night is a Hillary Clinton, Bernie Sanders town hall. So those two will be out there, and I will be back on Friday at noon. Have a great rest of the day. Thanks for listening. See ya.